Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Beyond the Stethoscope, a podcast focused on hospice palliative care. My name is Linda Meeks. I'm your host for this afternoon. I'm one of the education facilitators at the North Simcoe Muskoka Hospice Palliative Care Network. My guests today are Inga De Bruin, nurse consultant at the North Simcoe Muskoka Hospice Palliative Care Network, and Erica Rice, who is the coordinator of online learning and knowledge translation and exchange at the Alzheimer's Society of Ontario. Welcome, Inga, and welcome, Erica.
Thanks, Linda.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So today, we'll be speaking to Inga and Erica about a palliative approach to care, especially with dementia and Alzheimer's clients or patients. We have worked with Erica before in one of her previous roles. We are partners with the Regional Alzheimer's Society, where Erica used to work, and now obviously she has gone to the Alzheimer's Society of Ontario. So Inga, my first question is for you this afternoon. Could you define what is palliative care?
So palliative care is a multidisciplinary way of care to improve quality of life for people living with a life-limiting or life-threatening illness. We're looking to improve the experience of our patients, residents, or clients, but also improve the experience for their families.
And what is a palliative approach to care, and who provides that?
I think the best way to start off is to give you the definition by the WHO organization, the World Health Organization. And it says, and I'll read it to you, palliative care is an approach that improves the quality of life of patients and their families facing the problems associated with life-threatening illness through the prevention and relief of suffering by means of early identification, impeccable assessment, and treatment of pain and other symptoms, physical, psychosocial, and spiritual. So there's a whole bunch in that definition that is all very important. So key elements of hospice palliative care, it aims to relieve suffering and improves quality of life for the living as well as for the people that are going through their dying stage. It helps the person and families to address issues, expectations, needs, hopes and fears, prepare for self-determined life closure so that they do some planning, and for the dying process. We also help them cope with loss and grief during illness and bereavement. So also after the person, the loved one has passed away, we want to continue supporting the family members. It aims to treat all active issues, prevent new issues from occurring, and promote opportunities for meaningful experiences, personal and spiritual growth, and self-actualization. So the other question you asked, Linda, is who provides palliative care? We all do. Just think about it. If you think back about the definition, palliative approach to care should be done with anybody with a life-limiting or life-threatening illness. So that encompasses a whole bunch of people. That could be patients or people with cancer, with diabetes, with kidney problems, with lung problems, heart problems, and also people with dementia, because dementia is a life-limiting illness. So who provides palliative care? So think about the person that's working in a grocery store at the checkout. They come in contact with the person with a life-limiting or life-threatening illness. A hairdresser, teller at the bank, a bus driver or a taxi driver, a family physician, pharmacists, nurses, volunteers, PSWs, and the list goes on and on. We all do it, even though we might not realize that we do it.
And Erica, why is it important to consider a palliative approach to care for people living with dementia?
Well, when we think about dementia, lots of times people are, you know, the most common cause of dementia is Alzheimer's disease. And often people think of Alzheimer's disease as just about somebody having some memory problems. But Alzheimer's disease and other types of dementia, they affect far more than just memory problems. They really impact all aspects of a person's life. And they are progressive terminal illnesses. So you know, until we find a cure for the damage that the disease is causing in the brain, it will continue to cause more and more damage until the brain cannot keep the body going any longer. And then the person dies. So it is a life-limiting illness. It is a terminal illness, and it impacts the person's day-to-day life right from the very beginning and through the progression, which can happen over many, many years. And people have their life to live, you know, they want to have a good quality of life for as long as they're living. And so we all have, as Inga was mentioning, all of us have a part to play in helping somebody have a good quality of life. If it's that person at the grocery store that maybe can take a moment to step in and help somebody find that item that they're struggling to find, or a cashier who has the patience to allow somebody to figure out how to count out their money, or to, you know, how do I use my car, my credit card in this machine, and help them out with patience and understanding, can make a huge difference in that person's life. So it is really important to consider that palliative approach to care.
And can you explain for us, what is dementia?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of confusion about, and I get asked this a lot from people, especially in the public, but also from care partners, family and friends who are supporting someone. It's like, what is the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's disease? Because you hear those terms interchanged quite frequently. And I actually recall having a family member say, my healthcare provider, my GP, told me that there's no such thing as dementia anymore. So then there was confusion on top of that. So when you think about, we do continue to use that word dementia commonly in our society. So we are using that term. It is not the disease itself. It's an umbrella term that describes common symptoms that occur when somebody has a neurodegenerative disease. So a disease that's happening in the brain, it's causing damage, it's destroying neurons, it's interrupting chemical interactions between neurons. And it's resulting in changes, things like change in memory, but also problems with judgment and reasoning and language and interpreting sensory information and all those things that our brain does for us. And as you can imagine, those changes can really impact how a person can manage in their day to day. So we just wanted to make a note here, because I thought it was interesting with that family member who said, my doctor said there's no such thing as dementia, and what's going on with that? Is that if you look at the DSM-5, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which healthcare practitioners use to make diagnoses of different mental conditions, that it isn't no longer the term in there. It's either major neurocognitive disorder, which would equate to dementia, or mild neurocognitive disorder, which would equate to MCI, or mild cognitive impairment, as it's commonly called. So basically, it's the same thing. It's just a different terminology. So we wanted to just mention that today. But really, when you're thinking about what does that mean for the person, if there's a diagnosis of that major neurocognitive disorder or dementia, it's typically diagnosed when the amount of impairment, so there's enough damage happening in the brain that it's impairing the brain's ability to manage day to day. So it's really looking at how it's impacting social and occupational functioning for the individual. So it's based on function. So for example, someone can have, and they're finding this out, someone can have Alzheimer's disease pathology happening in their brain. So they have damage occurring from this disease, and they could be having that happening for years before it actually shows up as changes, as symptoms, until it actually starts impacting their day-to-day life. So it's not until it gets to that point where they would then be diagnosed with dementia. So dementia is really that common term that describes those changes that are impacting somebody's day-to-day functioning. And I also just wanted to note here, when we think about dementia, so often we talk about dementia in terms of losses, loss of memory, loss of language, loss of judgment, and so on. But when we're thinking about supporting people to live their best lives, I like Dr. Alan Power's new definition of dementia. So Dr. Power is the Schlegel Chair in Aging and Dementia Innovation at the Schlegel University of Waterloo Research Institute for Aging. And his definition is that dementia is a shift in the way that people experience the world around them. So if we think of it in that term, because it's our brain that gives us our experience of the world, and they have an illness that is harming their brain. So their experience of the world is shifting. And if we can understand that, come to terms with that, and then recognize what their experience is, then we can shift along with them. And that's how we can best support people living with dementia, is to kind of shift along with them and support them where they're at.
I really love that definition, Erica. And we've spoken previously about that definition. It can also be applied to other types of illnesses where family members, healthcare providers, and so on can actually shift their way of thinking into meeting the person where they're actually at and how beneficial that is to them. And Eric, and can you mention, or you did mention, that there can be many years from when the disease starts impacting the person's life to the end of their life. What are some of the changes people living with dementia experience in the early stages of the disease?
Yeah, thanks, Linda. And as I mentioned earlier, one of the things we typically think of right off the bat is memory loss. It's about memory changes. And certainly that is a big change. So, but there's difference between changes in memory just because we're getting older and we're getting a little more forgetful, having trouble paying attention to things like we used to, and when it's a memory loss that is a result of a neurodegenerative disease like Alzheimer's disease. So basically it's impacting the part of the brain that makes memories. So it's like, I don't even recall that thing happened. So maybe I had a conversation with somebody 2 hours ago, and now my brain didn't record that information. So I don't recall I had that conversation. So now I want to have that conversation again. But that individual I was talking to goes, well, what do you mean? We just talked about that 2 hours ago. Why are you asking that again? So those are the kinds of memory changes that start to occur when somebody is living with a disease like Alzheimer's disease. And when you're looking at how it impacts day-to-day activities. So not just around relationships like that, but also medication is a big example. You know, if I forgot that I took my medication, so I take it again, or I forget that I should be taking it, so I don't take it, that can also increase risk. I think of all the things we need our memory to do, to be able to remember what recently happened and how that impacts day-to-day activity. So that's really what we're looking at, is when memory loss starts to impact a person's ability to manage day-to-day. I think, but also things like changes in judgment. This is why there's a lot of work. You're thinking about the OPB does a lot of work with seniors, frauds, and scams, and why people target seniors, fraudsters, and scammers, because they know that age is the biggest risk factor for dementia, and dementia can impact judgment. So people are not making as good decisions any longer. So they're more vulnerable to those types of people, of activities. So that also increases their risk. You also need things like judgment for, well, driving. We need good judgment in order to drive safely. So this is a huge change that happens with people early on, is that at some point in the disease, and usually fairly early when things start to change, the ministry decides the person is no longer safe on the roads. And so they remove driving privileges. And think about how that impacts a person's quality of life if they can't just get in the car and drive to the store or go meet a friend or do whatever they want to do. So people can start to become more isolated. So we see increase in isolation. We can see problems with language, which can impact their ability to communicate with others. It could also impact their confidence. So decrease in confidence. I don't really want to go out with my friends because I'm struggling to follow the conversation. I'm unsure whether I just said that thing and I've been called out on it too many times. So now my confidence, I don't feel like I don't feel good in that situation any longer. So it all impacts the person and becomes more isolated. So there's a lot of changes that happen early on. And I hope, as you heard me talk about the changes, thinking about as a community, all the things that we could do to help support people who are experiencing those changes.
And Erica, how can we support people living with dementia while providing a palliative approach to care?
Well, I think a big one is being patient, having patience and having empathy around what people are going through, thinking about conversations. And, you know, if somebody does tell you the same story or wants to have the same conversation that you know you just had with them 2 hours ago, understanding this is part of the disease process and they don't have a recollection of having had that conversation. And so it's okay to listen again or participate in the conversation like you did the first time, and not make it a big deal, because people will pick up on the nonverbal cues. People with dementia, I mean, they start to struggle with the actual words that you're saying, but they'll pick up on the nonverbals, the facial expression, the tone of voice very quickly. And the emotional memory of interactions will last. So I might forget what you said to me when you said, "What do you mean? I just talked to you about that." But what I'll pick up on is your tone of voice when you say it and how it made me feel. And so, you know, for those of us who are interacting with people, is to be okay with imperfection and not call out mistakes, listen to that story again, answer that question again, really having that patience to just step back and go with the flow and let them take the lead. Again, stepping into their reality is shifting. We just need to go along with it. So those are huge things, being okay with imperfection. And learning some key communication strategies can be very, very helpful. Just things like resisting the need to correct the person unless you have to. Like, it's okay if they say something that you know is incorrect. As long as there's not risk to what they've said, can you just let it go? If the person maybe struggles to follow the rules of the game, is it really winning the game that matters? Or is it the relationship with the individual? You know, can you just not worry about it and say, "Hey, that's not what you're supposed to do," and just go with the flow? So those are some really important things that you could do. And there's a lot of other things that you could do as well, but maybe I'll let Inga answer the next question.
Hey, Inga, what can the palliative care network do to support people in the early stage of dementia?
Sure. So what palliative care looks like in the early stages of dementia is we can start having conversations for sure about advanced care planning, about wishes, about likes, about dislikes. And I think especially with people that are living with dementia, this is very important, because in the beginning stages, they can still participate in conversation. They might still have the ability to make some decisions for the future for themselves. So to help and facilitate, to guide perhaps some of those conversations that can be had between the person that's living with the dementia and their family and their friends and the healthcare system would be very helpful. When those conversations are had early, care partners can hold on to some of the information that they get from those conversations early on. And it can support them a whole lot when the person living with dementia gets farther into their disease and is losing those abilities of having conversations and decision making. And like I said before, everybody does palliative care. So all of us who come in contact with families and people living with dementia can help facilitate those conversations. And I know we have to do that in a way that it's comfortable for the person and their families, because some families are very easy going talking about death and dying and other people are not. Like in my family, it was a dinner table conversation, not a big deal. But I've seen other families working it differently from how they've been brought up, and they are having trouble having conversations. So sometimes it's very helpful if we can help them or facilitate them to have some of those conversations. To make connections for them, to make a connection with the Alzheimer's Society in a local Alzheimer's Society in their area. They are very great in having the conversations about advanced care planning and doing education for patient as well as family members. Myself, I normally don't get so much involved in the beginning phase. When I get a referral through whichever means, it might be a doctor's office, it might be a hospital, it might be a long-term care facility, or it might be a family member, normally the person is already much farther advanced in their dementia journey. They might still be living at home, or they might have been already placed in a retirement home or a long-term care facility. Staff and care partners are wondering about possible pain issues or behaviors. So things are changing. And then that's normally the time when I normally get called in to see if there's anything that I can support with to make quality of life better for the person living with dementia. And if we can improve their quality of life, it also improves the quality of life of the family members, the staff members, for all of us. And there is a quote from Peter Ashley. He's a gentleman living with dementia. And he says, death and dying should be a natural matter to discuss. Palliative care for me starts and should start the minute you get a diagnosis. This business of dying is quite a natural process. People tend to regard dying as something unnatural, but it isn't. And he's so true. I get goosebumps when I read this because it's so true. We are born, we will die. That is just a fact of life. And for people with a dementia diagnosis, the disease process is sometimes a very lengthy disease process.
Thank you, Inga. I understand why you love that quote, because I know it's one of your passions to help change the world in believing how we see dying. Erica, what programs does the Alzheimer's Society provide that support the quality of life for people living with dementia?
Well, the Alzheimer's Society has quite a few programs and offered in different types of formats. So maybe I'll talk about first some that are available to anyone, really. And this is a program that the Alzheimer's Society has been working on with other provincial societies and the Alzheimer's Society of Canada for a while. And it's called Dementia Friendly Communities. And it really is focused on providing education to the general public, but also to staff in different business sectors, community organizations, and so on. First of all, how to recognize when somebody might be needing some assistance. So sort of the signs that somebody might have dementia, not to call them out, but to recognize that, oh, maybe I need to step in and provide some support, and what kind of support that can be provided. So looking at a lot of communication strategies. So that is probably the biggest way that anyone in the general public can help support somebody living with dementia is changing the way that we communicate and that patience and empathy and so on. But also looking at the built environment. So when they're working with businesses, for example, retail, library, community centers, and so on, looking at their space and saying, how can we make this more dementia friendly? And a lot of this is very similar to the age friendly movement that's been happening for a number of years. And things like looking at lighting, and is lighting appropriate? Is there enough seating areas? Signage is a huge thing, especially when somebody might be struggling to recognize sensory information. One thing example I often think about is when I'm in a restaurant and I need to go use the washroom, and they have some kind of funky pictures on the washroom doors to indicate which is male and female. Sometimes I have to stop and look and go, okay, which one am I supposed to go and use? So with somebody who has dementia, this might be a real barrier. They might have no idea which one they're supposed to go into. So having clear signage that where there's limited room for confusion, you know, it's that having familiar graphics or simple words and clear at eye level so that people can see them. They're not placed in an odd position. Like, those things can make a huge difference. And some of those things can be easy changes for different businesses to make. Some might be a larger changes, but, you know, to work with these organizations to help them determine what kinds of changes they can make. So there are free e-learning modules that are available on the Alzheimer's Society's education portal, which is alzeducate.ca. And I think, Linda, you're going to be putting that website link on the website with the podcast. So they're free. And there's actually a module that is designed for professionals working in recreation and library sector. And then there's one for retail and restaurants, but which is also good for anyone in the general public, because it includes a lot of the interaction supports that people can do. And then there's one for public transportation. So those are the three sectors that were identified first, and then they're looking at more sectors in the years to come as we get more funding to create more of these modules. So they're free to take. I do encourage anyone to go on there. You get a really good understanding of what it might be like to live with dementia and some things that we can do to best support people living with dementia. But certainly, like Inga had mentioned, the local society. So in Ontario, when I first connected with the Palliative Care Network and doing some workshops with Inga, I was in an education role at the Alzheimer's Society of Simcoe County, which is one of our local societies in Ontario. And they do the direct education and support and services to people who are living in the communities. I've since, moved to a different position with the Alzheimer's Society of Ontario. And my role is to now support all of those local societies in Ontario, deliver education rather than doing it myself. But it really is those local societies that deliver the actual education. So I do encourage, if you're listening to this and you're interested in having some in-person, whether it's an actual in-person session or virtual over Zoom or something like that, to connect with your local Alzheimer's Society, because they all do have educators who can provide some of those really interactive learning sessions if that's what you're looking for. So I know in North Simcoe, Muskoka, there's the Alzheimer's Society of Simcoe County, and there's also the Alzheimer's Society of Muskoka. So depending on where you're at in this region, you can contact those local societies. But if you're outside of this region, just to go to the Alzheimer's Society's website, which is alzheimer.ca, and then find my local society from there, and it'll direct you to who you need to contact. So that's the dementia-friendly communities. And that's a big program of how we can best support people, especially in the early, people who are in the early stages of dementia, who are living at home still, or they're living in retirement communities. They're still going out, like they're going out to do their day-to-day, their shopping. Maybe they've lost their driving privileges, so they're taking public transportation. They're going out for walks in their local parks. You know, they're getting on with their life. So how can we all support these people to live their life to the fullest? Another program that the Alzheimer's Society delivers, and again, this is at the local society level, is this is a program for people who have been recently diagnosed with a dementia, whether it's Alzheimer's disease or vascular dementia or one of the many other types of diseases that causes those symptoms of dementia. And it's called Taking Control of Our Lives. It's an 8-week self-management program. The goal of this program is to help people living with dementia develop skills, increase self-confidence, and feel empowered to take control of their life by talking with and learning from others who have similar experiences. So those programs are offered in many of the local societies. I know both the Alzheimer's Society of Simcoe County and the Alzheimer's Society of Muskoka have offered those programs. They can only be done in person. So they've offered them before the pandemic, but now they're planning to start offering them again in the coming months, as long as we can continue to do so safely. So to contact the local society. And the last thing I want to mention is the First Link Care Navigation. So each local society has a First Link Care Navigator, and this person is really the first point of contact with the local society, who will have a conversation with the person, whether it's a person who's been recently diagnosed or maybe it's a family member or friend who's supporting that individual, and to help get them connected to services that the Alzheimer's Society provides, but also to other community services that would best support what they need to live life well. So whether that is getting them connected to the palliative care network or getting them connected to adult day programs that are available, all of those kinds of things that we happen in the community that can be very community specific. So it helps them navigate what's available to help support their quality of life.
Those are absolutely fantastic resources. And as Erica mentioned, we will be posting some of these resources underneath the podcast on our website. So please look for them there. As Alzheimer's disease and other types of dementia are progressive in nature, what are some changes people experience as the disease progresses beyond the early stage?
So some changes, thinking about the ones I mentioned that people have early on. So the risk increases and change in judgment, change in memory, and so on. Basically, all those changes get worse. So as there's more damage happening in the brain, because it's a progressive illness, the memory will get worse, judgment will get worse. The ability to use language to either express themselves or to comprehend what other people are saying is going to get harder. So everything starts to get a little bit more difficult for the individual. And so what starts to happen is risk increases. If somebody is living alone, and they have a number of medications that they need to take. And, I'm thinking in my head, my mom, who's in her 80s living alone, and she's diabetic. So she needs to take an insulin injection 4 times a day. if she's not able to do that, she doesn't remember that she took it, so she takes it again, or she forgets it, and that puts her at a great risk because she's not managing her diabetes properly. So that really can increase the risk of not allowing her to live home alone, because she doesn't have anybody there to help manage her insulin. Then maybe she's no longer able to live in her condo independently anymore. So that is a huge change. Often people have to change living their living environment, either go to assisted living or to long-term care, because they can't manage those kinds of risks, or even like risks around paying their bills on time, remembering that I have to pay my bills. So they haven't paid their hydro bill for 3 months and suddenly their power is cut off, or they're trying to, prepare food and forget that they left a pot on the stove, or they put meat out to thaw, but they left it there for 3 days and then they see it on the counter, not realizing that it's been there for 3 days, and go to cook it. I mean, there's so many different risks that can start to increase. And if somebody doesn't have a person that's there managing those things for them, that can really increase the need to go to a different care setting. But even if they do have someone who's there 24/7 helping manage these risks, for the care partners, the stress that they have also increases as the disease progresses and can get to the point where they just cannot manage it any longer. And also people have increasing care needs. So as the disease progresses, that they're no longer able to necessarily dress themselves independently, shower, bathe, might need help with toileting. So, you know, that might be more than what the family can manage at home as well. So we do see some of those decisions, a big one being a change in where they live.
What decisions are people being asked to make as the disease progresses to this stage, Erica?
Yes, I kind of got ahead of myself. So a big one is that decision about where am I going to live? And this is a huge one that the families try to figure out. Do I go to long-term care? There's a lot of different retirement or care home options now available. So whether it's independent living that might offer some supports, assisted living, there's now a lot of retirement communities that offer memory care, so specialized memory care for people living with dementia.
Can I interject?
So yeah.
if you come back and thinking about the advanced care planning early on, or the conversations early on that need to be had, at that point, when a person is not at this stage yet in their disease process, they perhaps can plan ahead, do some planning, have some conversation, have some input in what that is going to look like for them. I know there's multiple people living with dementia early on that are aware and are making plans for what is going to happen with them when they get up to a stage this far into the disease process.
And, you know, I think that having some help to manage those discussions, whether it's through the Alzheimer's Society or through the Palliative Care Network, can be really helpful, because those are some discussions that families struggle to have and maybe never have. I've heard from so many family members that what they heard was, I don't ever want to go to long-term care. And so they tried to honor that wish of their family member. And it's almost like, unless you have infinite resources, if somebody goes through the whole progression of this illness, for most families, that's just not a realistic option. And so then there's all the emotion that goes with it when the family is no longer able to manage at home and they have to look at long-term care, and then they have all the guilt and the grief becomes even greater. So having someone to maybe facilitate those conversations early enough so that the person can actually participate and still has the ability to understand and have the insight and the reasoning early on to have those conversations could be very, very helpful. Because we do, when people haven't had those conversations, it can really increase the guilt, the family discord often can happen because people are just not on the same page. Because they don't know what their family member would have wanted, or they haven't realistically looked at what this progression of the disease could look like and made some of those decisions early on. So it can cause that family conflict. And thinking about also financial considerations are a big play in this too. I mean, the more, there's a lot of supports that you can access, but there's only a limited amount of supports that can be accessed that is covered through our healthcare dollars. So if people don't have the extra money to pay for additional supports or to pay for, you know, additional retirement, like say memory care in a retirement home or whatever, then that also limits their options. So there's a lot that people are going through.
Inga, what supports are available at the Hospice Palliative Care Network for family members or friends to help them navigate these decisions?
So at the Palliative Care Network, the North Simcoe Muskoka Hospice Palliative Care Network, we have consultants that are in all of the areas. We've got about 10 of us all spread around. We also have Hospice Aurelia, that is a program underneath the network, who has volunteers that can support people when they're still in their homes and support the care partners by perhaps taking a couple hours of being with the person with the dementia so that they can go to the store or to the bank or perhaps even just to go for a nap if that's what is needed. There is a lot of linkages that are being done. Like if I would be involved with a person with a dementia diagnosis, I would first of all try and link them, see if they are willing to make that linkage to the Alzheimer's Society. I think that's foremost. They are the experts in this area. And I think we need to get all the expertise that we can get into the team. Another one that I might call on is home and community care services. Depending what's happening. And you always got to think, are the people ready? Like I've seen during this time of COVID that a lot of people that had family members living with dementia have shied away from having PSW support coming into the home or even the nurses to come into the home because of the fear of anybody bringing in COVID. And there is not a lot of support out there, even if they at the moment would want some of the supports. It is not very pretty looking out there in the times of COVID at the moment. But I think that's about all I can. I know there's, we of course have education sessions. Like I partner with the local Alzheimer's societies to do some education, which is open for everybody, for people living with dementia as well, for care partners as well, for staff members. And if there's anything that we can support them with in the way of the discussions, the conversations about advanced care planning parts, we're always willing to do that as well.
Thanks so much, Inga. Erica, could I please ask you the same questions? What supports would be available from the Alzheimer's Society to help them navigate these decisions?
Yeah, thanks, Linda. Before I mention some supports that help people live well, especially earlier in dementia-friendly communities and the self-management program. But the Alzheimer's Society does have a progressive learning series for family members and friends. And so as the disease progresses, there is one called Care Essentials and another one called You First for Care Partners that really focuses on understanding behavior changes and helping the family member or friend build skills to help them meet unmet needs, address the behavior changes, provide the kind of quality support for them, for their person living with dementia, but also for themselves as the disease progresses and we see more behavior changes. There's also a course called Options for Care that is focused in on what supports do I need at home? What are my care options? Thinking about like care homes and retirement and understanding all of those options, but then also thinking about long-term care. When's the right time to apply for long-term care? How does that process work? And then also the transitioning. So helping the person living with dementia transition to another care setting, but also as a care partner, helping the emotional impact and helping yourself as you transition care roles. Because often we'll have, for example, a spouse, they've been married 50 years and the spouse has been that primary care partner for 5 years now, and it's getting too much for them. So, you know, their spouse moves to long-term care and then feeling like now what am I? Who am I? What's my role? I was the, you know, am I a spouse? Am I a care partner? What am I now? Sort of thing. And so there's a lot of emotional impact that people are dealing with. And so helping them as they transition along with them into a different care setting. But with that emotional impact, people need that one-to-one support so often, or some people find that peer support. And so there's a number of peer support groups that meet regularly is what they really need to help with that, is being able to talk to other people who are experiencing similar things. So those are the kinds of supports that are available at the local society level. Thinking about, well, I think I mentioned the Palliative Care Network and the Alzheimer's Society as well can help link to other supports outside of the Alzheimer's Society that might be helpful. I know we try to encourage people to connect with their local hospices because people, especially the community supports that hospices have, those kind of emotional supports for care partners, if they have friendly visiting programs, those kinds of things that can give them a bit of respite so they can have a bit of a break. So those are the kinds of things that the Alzheimer's Society can provide as the disease progresses.
What training does the Alzheimer's Society provide for healthcare providers?
The Alzheimer's Society does have a training program. It's called Youth First for Healthcare Providers. It is meant for non-registered staff, and it's a complement to the PCES training, which is for registered staff. And that is owned by PCES Canada, but Youth First for Healthcare Providers uses the same PCES framework as that holistic way of looking at the whole person to try to understand behavior changes and address unmet needs. So it is a 6-hour workshop. It costs $80 per person. It's available either as an e-learning course on our education platform or as a 6-hour workshop that can be delivered over Zoom, or they're starting to offer them in person again. And they've also just created, it's called You First Advanced, which is like the next steps in the training program. So people who have taken You First for Healthcare Providers and they've taken that framework and they've been implementing it in their workplace as they support their clients or their residents, and then being able to come back into another workshop and talk with others to talk about their experience using the framework and kind of delve deeper into the curriculum. So those are the two programs that the Alzheimer's Society owns and delivers. But I know a lot of times our educators and local societies will provide education to professionals either on a needs basis. So if an organization says, I need somebody to come in for an hour to talk to my staff on this topic, they can do that. And sometimes they are also trained in other dementia training programs that might be owned by other organizations outside of the Alzheimer's Society as well. So best to contact a local society to see what they have to offer.
Inga, how does the Palliative Care Network support changes at the end stage of dementia?
So what I normally do when I get a referral and when I get involved is, of course, to do a good assessment with the history of the person. I'll go into the file and look through all the information that is there. I have a little story about that. A couple of weeks ago, I met a lady in a long-term care facility, and I was asked to come and assess to see if there was anything that they could do to improve her quality of life. So I went through her file and I saw that she was an old nurse from way back when. So this lady was sitting in a tilted wheelchair, kind of in front of the nurse's station. And if you're just sitting there watching her, you wouldn't think that there was a lot of person left there, if that's the right way of putting it. But to just not shy away. So I went and sat with her, and at some point I said, "So I understand you are a nurse." She says, "Oh yeah, a long time ago." And it came out so clear, even though she was not using full sentences in anything else that she was doing. It was just so profound to know that, you know, those people have had lives, they have had jobs, they had families. Like, we know who the person is that we are talking about and who we are trying to improve the quality of life for. So first of all, meet the person, do a good full history, go through your the charting that's there, any of the documentation that you can find. Talk to staff members, talk to family members to get all the information that you can get. Look at diagnosis, look at medications that are using, look at the medications that have been used in the past, what has worked, what has not worked, and then pull all those pieces of a puzzle together. I always look at it as it's a big puzzle. I just pull all the little pieces together. And then sometimes it's trial and error to try and find things that are going to work to either if we are suspecting there might be pain or discomfort or anxiety or nausea, whatever might be the case, that we can see if we can change the experience that the person is having. And if we can change that experience for the person that's living with the dementia, then that changes the experience for family members, for the staff members, for everybody that's in contact with the person. Another thing that's really nice about what we are doing as consultants is if this person would be going from the long-term care facility where she is at the moment and needs to go to hospital for whatever kind of reason, I can follow her there. There's no barriers for me in settings. I can go from hospital to long-term care to retirement home to community, group homes, even jails. There is no boundaries for me. So, which is a real nice way of continuing the care with the people that I take care of.
Thank you, Inga. On the podcast with us today are some of the other nurse consultants from the North Simcoe Muskoka Hospice Palliative Care Network. So I'd like to open it up to see if there's any questions, comments, anything about stories that you'd like to tell before we end our session with Inga and Erica today. Laura?
I have a story. In the long-term care home I worked at previously, there was a huge Montessori program, and that is similar to the Montessori teachings for young children in terms of meeting people where they are, what their abilities are, and what they enjoy. And we had a gentleman in the locked unit who had dementia and had previously been a postal delivery person. So very much was an active man and who liked to sort things and would be often found in other people's rooms sorting their belongings, looking for things to do. So we gathered up a large number of a variety of colors and sizes of envelopes and put different stamps on them and at different addresses and asked him to help us sort the mail, and he lit up in joy when he sat and sorted the envelopes for us. It allowed him to feel useful, and it spoke to a skill that he had previously and allowed the staff to keep him out of other people's rooms without resorting to any sort of medication or other not so nice things.
I love that story, Laura. It's so simple, but yet it's not. When you know that you're working in the healthcare system, it's not really thought of, but that is just so simple when you put it that way. I love that story. Kathleen, and did you?
We used it frequently. Anytime he started to get restless, we would bring out the pile of envelopes and it settled him. It just brought him so much joy and peace to feel useful.
I think that also shows just how important in dementia care that it needs to be person-centered. And that means you need to know the person. You need to know about what they did and what's important to them and what their skills are, and so that you could use that information.
Kathleen, did you have anything that you wanted to say or ask?
I have stories similar to Laura's, and that whenever I worked in long-term care previous as a PSW on a locked unit, we had people bring in pretend babies or little stuffed animals, and the residents would take care of those as though they were their own and just reverted back to that. And it was just such a nice way of them keeping busy. So it's the little things that make the world of difference for them. And I wish that more people would see that and help them out.
Great. Thank you. Hi, Rachel. Did you have anything that you wanted to add today to the podcast?
Nothing so much to add, but just a little bit of a comment. Over the years, I've watched a number of different movies around dementia and people who have dementia. I think one of them was called Finding Alice, which I found quite interesting. And I've another one was most recently in the last year, and I cannot remember the name of it, but maybe you might know, it was with Anthony Hopkins. And he was a senior gentleman who had dementia, and his daughter was navigating that journey with him, trying to look after him and keeping him in his own home. And it was, called The Father. Amanda put in here that it was called The Father. And I've found I've learned so much watching some of those films, because I think what I'm seeing is really true to life. Certainly there's a Hollywood component to it, but some of the main components to it, some of the experiences that family is dealing with, the experiences that the patients themselves are dealing with, that in and out of current and present time, and the confusion and the feelings of being distraught that they experience in those is quite burdensome, and it really pulls at your heartstrings. I remember one film, or maybe it was a documentary that I was watching, and one of the memory units that individuals were placed on, they had it decorated much like it was a community outside. So instead of having a chair in the hallway that looked like, you know, a hospital chair or a business chair, or an office chair, they had it set up to look like it might be a bus stop. And they had signage around that had memorabilia that was relatable to them, because a lot of the people were within a certain, age range. And so, you know, what they were putting as far as decorative stuff was appropriate for them, so they would feel comfortable in those locations versus looking at it and simply not recognizing anything because their memory was so much from the past. So I just find things like that quite interesting. And if we can incorporate that as much as we can, you know, in our future learning and how we're making plans and places for these individuals to feel comfortable and make them feel as though they have portions of their humanness still connected.
Thanks, Rachel. That's so interesting to say that some information does actually come from movies that come from Hollywood. I know my favorite movie is called The Notebook. And now that I think of it, it is a story about a couple who is going through the journey of dementia or Alzheimer's. So thank you, everyone.
Oh, and sorry. That legacy piece, if you think about The Notebook, Linda, sorry, that's one of my all-time faves.
Yeah.
The story that woman wrote, because she knew she had dementia, this is the Hollywood part of it, but the reality is it was a piece of legacy work that we can do. And yes, that was, pumped up to make it more Hollywood, but there can be some legitimacy to doing a narrative such as that for someone who is losing their memory as a bit of recall for them later on.
So true. So I think we're coming to the end of our time together. So I would especially like to thank Inga and Erica for joining me today. The information that you gave us was completely astounding. I learned so much every single time that we talk about this. And as mentioned earlier, we will put the resources below the podcast on the website. And thank you to the other nurse consultants who have joined us today and shared some of their stories. Thank you so much.